Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. From mail-in voting to executive power, we discuss the latest decisions from the Supreme Court. Meet the latest candidate to announce a bid for mayor, Mike Quigley.
It is really based on the idea that people that live in the local community are closest to the problem and more of the solution.
How community violence interventionists are working to prevent violence and promote public safety. First off tonight, Cook County is under an extreme heat warning through Wednesday night, and the dangerously hot and humid conditions will remain for most of the week.
We want people to be weather aware about any weather condition, but certainly heat. Heat is kind of one of those sneaky things, in a sense, relative to a thunderstorm coming or a blizzard. You don't necessarily realize the effects until it's too late. And the effects of heat are cumulative. So day by day that goes by that you don't have that ability to recover or cool off, the effects are worsening. So we want people to be preparing early on.
The National Weather Service says Chicago's high temperatures will hit the mid-90s with heat index values reaching between 100 and 105 degrees with little to no lake cooling. City officials are asking residents to hydrate, stay cool, and check on your neighbors, especially the elderly and those with disabilities or pre-existing conditions. The chance for thunderstorms will increase later this week, which might bring some relief. For information on where to find one of the city's cooling centers, you can visit our website. Chicago renters could have some new protections under a bill proposed by Mayor Brandon Johnson and the Department of Housing. The Protecting Renters Ordinance would create a tenant's bill of rights, a rental registry requiring annual registration of all rental units, a new Bureau of Rental Housing Services to process and investigate complaints, and require landlords to provide just cause for eviction or non-renewal. The mayor's office says the ordinance would modernize the existing residential landlord and tenant ordinance introduced back in 1986. The city says 54% or 622,000 Chicago residents are renters, and over 40% of them are cost burdened, meaning they spend more than 30% of income on rent. What do Chicago music legends Buddy Guy, Mavis Staples, Frankie Knuckles, and Jeff Tweedy have in common? As of today, they all have endangered baby birds named after them. The four piping plover chicks that hatched at Montrose Beach this month will be known as Buddy, Mavis, Frankie, and Tweety. The names were chosen through a contest run by a coalition of bird groups looking for names that reflect Chicago's heritage, culture, and diversity. The Park District says musicians' names are fitting since the scientific name for piping plover, Charadrius Melodus, means melodious singing. There you go. How will birders know who's who? Unique color-coded leg band combinations. Up next, making sense of the latest Supreme Court rulings right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
So we're down to the final days of a hugely consequential Supreme Court term. Today, the court weighed in on two high-profile firings from earlier in President Trump's second term, and two conservative justices sided with liberals on a mail-in voting case. Joining us to talk about those cases and preview what's to come tomorrow is Carolyn Shapiro, co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States at the Chicago-Kent College of Law. Ms. Shapiro also clerked for former Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Welcome back, Carolyn. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Brandis.
So what did the Supreme Court decide today in the mail-in voting case?
So this is a case called Watson versus Republican National Committee. In this case, the RNC sued the state of Mississippi over their a mail-in ballot law that allowed for the state to accept ballots that were mailed by Election Day, postmarked by Election Day, but received for up to 5 days after. And the RNC said that violates the law that Congress passed designating a particular day as Election Day. And the Supreme Court rejected that, uh, that of that interpretation of the federal statute. I think it did so wisely. It would have been incredibly chaotic this many weeks or months out from the midterm to suddenly require states that allow mail-in balloting to arrive after Election Day to suddenly say, oh, that's illegal. And the statute really doesn't say anything one way or the other about mail-in ballots. It does appropriately, I think, indicate that you can't vote after Election Day. But if the votes are in the mailbox, if that's what your state allows, they can be received after Election Day.
What might this mean for other states that have mail-in balloting as well?
Well, I think they're all breathing a sigh of relief. I mean, there are states that have mail-in ballots, but they require them to be received by Election Day. So different states are different, and that's part of the system that we have. States are primarily responsible for elections. So this means that states don't have to change anything. Had the case come out the other way, lots of states might have had to change something. And it also would have, I think, called into question early voting because of this emphasis on Election Day itself. But the way this court interpreted the statute, I don't think that's likely to be a problem.
The court also made a ruling on the firing of an FTC commissioner in the Trump versus Slaughter case. Give us the background on that case, Carolyn.
So the Trump has fired a number of executive branch officials who work for or who are commissioners or board members of multi-member agencies. So the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is one of those. There are five commissioners. No more than three are supposed to be from any one party. And they are appointed for a term of years. I think it's 5 years. And they're staggered. So when a new president comes in, he may be able to appoint some new commissioners, but not replace all of them. And they are not supposed to be removed except for what's called cause, which means essentially not doing your job, dishonesty, that kind of thing. President Trump said, no, I have the right to fire anybody I want. And that is what happened in this case. The Supreme Court said, yeah, he's right, and in so doing, overruled a 90-year-old precedent, squarely overruled it. It's a case called Humphrey's Executor, and it expressly upheld the statute creating the FTC against exactly the same challenge. Congress has created numerous agencies modeled on the FTC, which is one of the earliest ones. Operations, their constitutionality are all in significant doubt, and I would expect we're going to see a firing spree by Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's where a lot of folks are concerned now that the president has this power, that a lot of those agencies, those commissions, those boards could start to turn over. But the court made a separate decision regarding the firing of Lisa Cook, a Federal Reserve governor. What did justices decide there?
So there, the court said, well, the Federal Reserve is different. There are good reasons for Congress to make the central bank independent of politics in a way that they don't seem to think is appropriate for other types of agencies. It is, in fact, a very confusing set of opinions. If you, for the two justices who joined the majority in both, which is the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh, the two opinions really can't be reconciled. They're both written by the Chief Justice. And part of the reason they really can't be reconciled is because he relies on history so differently in the two cases. To say in one case, well, this is the way Congress has done this for a long time. That's in the Fed case. And on the other hand, saying, well, even though Congress has done this for a long time, based on some conversations and debates that were had over a slightly different issue back in 1789, I think they're not allowed to do it. So the disruption to our government is just beside the point.
Are there other avenues that Trump can use to replace Cook, or what is to happen with her?
Yeah, so what the court said is he can only fire her for cause. What he had said is, I'm firing you for cause because there's reason to believe you committed mortgage fraud. She never had the opportunity to say, no, that's not true, even though the statute itself requires her to be given that opportunity. So basically, it's going back down. There's going to be a process, I presume, where Donald Trump says, this is why I'm firing you for cause. She'll have the ability to say, I didn't do that, or that's not reasonable cause. And then a court will probably, he'll probably say, yes, you're still fired, and then there will be an adjudication about whether a court can even evaluate that determination on the merits, and if so, whether his decision stands.
What do these decisions from this term tell us about the court's view, taking into account these and others, the court's view of executive power?
Court's view of executive power is extraordinary. I think the framers would be quite frankly shocked by it. They are giving the president increasing amounts of unreviewable power. We see that in the Slaughter case today, the FTC case. We saw that in the immigration cases last week. We're seeing that. We saw that. Certainly saw that in the immunity case, Trump versus United States. So I think they have a kind of unlimited belief that the president is the embodiment of the country in some sense. It will be interesting to see if they behave the same way if there's a Democratic president in the future, because they've also given themselves a lot of tools to say, well, actually, in this case, the president is overreaching. We don't think the statute allows the president to do this particular thing, and particularly in context where the president is trying to regulate. You can think back to Biden's efforts to forgive student loans, for example.
And briefly, we've got about 15 seconds left. Decision is expected tomorrow in the challenge to birthright citizenship. What are the arguments there?
Well, the arguments there are, what does the 14th Amendment mean what it says, which is that if you're born here, you're a citizen, or is there a way of reading something very broad into what was otherwise an extremely narrow exception, the word subject to the jurisdiction thereof? I think that the court will strike down the executive order undermining birthright citizenship.
Okay. All eyes on the Supreme Court tomorrow. Carolyn Shapiro, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Up next, Congressman Mike Quigley on his bid for mayor of Chicago. Northwest Side Congressman Mike Quigley is officially running for Chicago mayor. The nine-term representative from Illinois' 5th District launched his campaign Saturday at the historic but crumbling Uptown Theater, using the landmark as a symbol of what he says is needed to restore Chicago's promise. Quigley joins a crowded race in the February 2027 mayoral election, becoming the fourth candidate to enter the contest this month. Joining us now to talk about his campaign is Mike Quigley, Democratic congressman and now candidate for mayor. Congressman, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
So it's great to be back.
You've been in Washington for the last 17 years. What made you want to throw your hat in the ring for mayor?
Yeah, it's tough to watch the city you love so much struggle the way that we are in Chicago. The fact of the matter is Chicago has everything it needs to succeed. Its location, its people, its cultural institutions, its universities, its neighborhoods, and so much more. But it's all resting on a crumbling financial foundation that needs to be fixed. That's something I worked hard on when I was Cook County Commissioner, appearing on Channel 11 quite a bit, and it's something I now realize that someone has to take on directly.
Your life as a public servant has been spent mostly as a legislator. Are you prepared to move into the executive role?
Certainly. I mean, look, I got my master's in public policy from the University of Chicago. And as you might recall, as a county commissioner, I wrote detailed reports about how to restructure the county and how local government can be more efficient. You know, those are the kinds of reports that we need to put into place here if Chicago is going to succeed. I think the most important aspect of the talent the next mayor has is the willingness to make tough choices. And I've certainly done that, not just as a Cook County commissioner, but serving in Congress. As you recall, I was the first one to tell Biden he needs to step aside. I was with Obama on his trade deals and many of his other tough votes. So you need someone who knows what to do, but has also had experience making those tough choices.
So you've said the city would be or could be insolvent by the time the next mayor is elected. How dire would you say the city's financial situation is?
Well, somewhere between 30% and 40% of our revenues are going to debt and pension. The fact is, when the property tax bills were late, there was a real tough time making those monthly pension payments. So any blip in the economy, and I'm very, very concerned that our pension funds, being so poor, aren't going to be able to make the required payments. The city itself has a structural deficit that's only getting worse. So, what happens between now and next mayor when the next mayor takes office is really going to depend on what those risks are. We have a very real chance that we won't be able to meet our obligations. And the concern is that with short-term borrowing and risky borrowing and not taking on these tough choices, the situation will indeed be dire.
What would you do to get the city back on track?
I think the first thing you do is change the climate and the culture and recognize that this is a city that needs to work again. You know, we have too many slow zones on the CTA. It shouldn't cost $1 billion a mile to extend the red line, even though I'm a big fan of that and got the money out of the House for the extension of the red line. And we have not just a financial crisis, but a housing crisis. We're probably 100,000 units short of where we need to be. When I was getting out of college, 28 was the average age for a first-time home buyer. It's now 40. And for too many Chicagoans, there's never a chance to own that first home. So we're going to focus on affordability, starting with housing. Our North Star is to build between 50 and 100,000 new units within the next decade. The city's down 1 million in population from the early 50s. We have to move in the other direction. We are simply not going to be able to tax our way out of this problem. We're going to have to grow our way out of this problem, but we can do it.
Congressman, you've said that you want to make cuts to the city's budget as well, since spending on public safety, now including the police department, accounts for 2/3 of the city's discretionary spending. Would cuts to CPD be on the table for you?
No, I think the way to address public safety is to use the programs like CRED, ceasefire, the anti-violence programs that President Trump has cut so much. I think we need to spend more on those because I do believe they're cost effective. I think the way to go after our city's finances is to address the fact that we actually have a higher worker count than we did before COVID, and that hasn't gone down. Our budget's gone up and still hasn't gone down. So again, the reports I wrote about how to streamline and consolidate local government will fit into play here. You saw a little bit of that with Ernst & Young's reports that talked about cost sharing, about centralizing procurement, a whole list of things that, again, we detailed over 20 years ago. They have to be put in place right away to begin the cost savings.
Another issue at the top of mind for many Chicagoans is the Bears and whether or not they will leave Chicago for Indiana. But you've said that retaining the Bears in Chicago would not be a top priority for you. Why not?
Well, I think at this point in time, it's up to the General Assembly to make that call. So by the time next May rolls around, this decision will be made. It's really hard to say that the Bears are a priority when we're short of housing, when our schools are overcrowded in some areas, when we're just not getting the job done. How can I tell people who want better schools, who need more police, who want so many other public services like shelter beds, that we're gonna help the billionaires build a new stadium? It just can't be the priority. If the General Assembly wants to act, my best guess is that Arlington Heights is where they're likely going to end up. I think there's still concerns with the site locations in Indiana. But in the final analysis, this is a decision for the governor, the General Assembly. I want the Bears to say it's a stay, but for me to say that's a higher priority than public safety or our schools is just a mistake.
So before we run out of time, as I'm sure you know, two of your Democratic colleagues in the House from New York lost their primary challenges to far left candidates. Many are reviewing the results of that election as an indicator that voters are rejecting the more centrist and establishment candidates. Of course, Brandon Johnson himself is from the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Are Chicagoans ready to elect a more moderate candidate?
You know, I think New York stands by itself, and I'll let those voters make their own choice. But we also, the Democrats also elected several very moderate governors, right? So I think you have to take it case by case. I think the citizens of Chicago recognize the crisis that we're in. They have a progressive agenda. I have a progressive agenda. But if we're spending 40% of our revenues paying for debt, paying for our pensions, well, we're simply not going to be able to commit to any sort of agenda, much less a progressive one.
Okay. Congressman Mike Quigley, also candidate for Chicago mayor, thank you for joining us. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Up next, local community violence intervention groups strive for a safer Chicago. Stay with us. Summer in Chicago usually means a spike in gun violence. While overall crime has been on a downward trend, the city is nevertheless on pace to pass last year's shooting and homicide numbers, with June seeing 36 murders and 132 shootings, both up from 2025. Police are first responders, but some groups think there's a better way to handle gun violence: community prevention. Community violence interventionists, or CVI professionals, walk high-risk neighborhoods, hoping to interrupt the cycle of violence through direct outreach and trust building. We spent the day with one team to see what it's all about.
Hello, how y'all doing today, man?
On a sunny day in Garfield Park, Ray Ray from the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago checks in with his team of peacekeepers.
For the most part, everything's been cool.
This group of community violence interventionists, or CVIs, strolls the neighborhood, making contact with people, chatting about what's happening, and building trust along the way.
But I got a little info on it, so I'm trying to get more.
This is exactly what Vaughn Bryant, executive director of Metropolitan Peace Initiative, wants to see.
Community violence intervention is basically sort of a non-punitive approach to gun violence. We're more preventative and intervention. You know, police are more accountability and trying to bring justice.
Bryant knows community relations with the police are fraught and have been for a long time.
A number of factors have led to the mistrust of police. There are policies and procedures that, you know, cities have that the law enforcement, like police, are enforcing that can be racist.
He sees a way for police to work with CVIs to make communities safer.
It is really based on the idea that people that live in the local community are closest to the problem and more of the solution.
Samuel Castro at the Institute for Nonviolent Chicago agrees.
Lived experience is something that you can't learn out of a book. This is something that we went through.
Castro and Bryant aren't alone in this mission of community activism. Metropolitan Peace Initiative gathered 15 area organizations to form the Communities Partnering for Peace. Castro feels relationship with the community is crucial, but knows they also need to connect with Chicago police.
What we have created with law enforcement is a professional understanding. We have to build a trust. So from CPD, not to think that CVI organization staff are the same drivers of violence, the same people that used to sell drugs.
Bryant agrees and says CVIs must strike a delicate balance.
We have sort of a one-way communication line, so we get information from the police, but we don't give information to the police because that would ruin the credibility and the trust that we have.
It's work that's been ongoing for years, yet has further to go.
We want to get to a place where people just commit fewer crimes because they see opportunity to thrive.
There's no magical powder in the air. There's real humans doing the work that have been impacted by violence, trauma all through their life, and we're running back to the fire to help people.
So for now, Bryant and Castro stay the course.
In 10 years from now, I'm hoping we could put ourselves out of business, make the community safer.
We did contact the Chicago Police Department to talk with us for this story, but they declined. You can see more stories on community violence prevention and police and policing on our website. That's at WTTW.com/policing.
WTTW News coverage of policing and police reform is supported by the Joyce Foundation.
And that's our show for this Monday night. You can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.